You are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Foundation podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell. I'm your host, Bradley Olson. On this podcast, we share archived audio lectures given by Joseph Campbell over the course of his teaching and lecturing career, giving you, the listener, a chance to hear Campbell engage his material charismatically, artfully, and always with remarkable erudition and unfailing humanity. Today's lecture on Occidental and Oriental ideas was recorded in 1966 at Mary Baldwin University in Staunton, Virginia. The second volume in the Masks of God series, called Oriental Mythology, had just been published in 1962, and Volume 3, Occidental Mythology, was published in 1964. At the time of the 1966 lecture you're about to hear, Campbell was at the peak of his mastery of and comfort with the contrasting ideas between Asia and the West, and he was probably knee-deep in Volume 4 of the Masks of God series, Creative Mythology, which was to be published in 1968. I know that The Hero with a Thousand Faces gets much of the attention when it comes to Campbell's work, but the Masks of God series is, in my opinion, the outstanding achievement of Joseph Campbell's career. I've read nothing quite like it in terms of its scale, its scope, and its range. In Professor Campbell's introduction to the Masks of God volumes, he writes that he spent 12 delightful years on these four volumes, which suggests that by the time of this lecture, given in 1966, he had already spent the better part of a decade researching, writing, and living with these ideas. In Professor Campbell's view, an imaginary line through modern Iran divides the East and the West, and both have two major cultural zones. To the east of Persia, there's India, or South Asia, and East Asia, China, the Korean Peninsula, and Japan. To the west of Persia, there's Europe and the Levant. The Levant is a large area in the eastern Mediterranean region, which includes the contemporary constellation of the Middle East. I think that one of Joseph Campbell's gifts is to be able to pull back and see a big picture, and his observation of the relative isolation of the East is just such an example of this. When one looks at a map, it's easy to see how China and Japan, and to a slightly lesser degree India, are all cut off from the rest of the continent by the Himalayan mountain range, the immense Gobi Desert, and the sea. This relative isolation facilitates essentially stable traditions which are recognizable over long periods of time, unlike the West, in which great changes in traditional thought and behavior is a hallmark. In the lecture you're about to hear, Professor Campbell wades into the difference between East and West with appreciation, humor, and an impressive grasp of the religious and mythical traditions of the East and the West, and their ongoing impact on our daily contemporary lives. So please enjoy this 1966 lecture on Oriental and Occidental mythologies. And immediately following his talk, I'll be back with some final remarks and talk about some of the important ideas from the lecture and provide some context and elaboration on ideas Professor Campbell referred to in his talk.
Some weeks ago, I had a rather startling experience when a young Indian friend of mine, who is a very saintly young man, a little angel actually, was sitting talking to me and said, you know, when I visit foreign countries, I like to study their religions and find out something about their religious life. And so he said, I have brought a Bible and I am reading the Bible. And he said, I can't find any religion in it. Well, one has to try to understand a thing like that. Then I recalled having read in the writings of Western missionaries in India descriptions of Indian religion, which would make you think that there was no religion there. So it seems to me a likely topic then, the ideals of East and West, a contrast. The way to begin this study is to decide where the East begins. And I think the place to draw the line for a very clear definition is through Persia, through Iran. Eastward of Persia, there are two great creative zones, zones of cultural creativity. One is India, and the other is the Far East, China, and then Japan. West of Iran, there are two great creative culture zones. One is the Near East, which I'll call the Levant, and the other is Europe. Now, these two zones in the West, the Levant and Europe, are united by the Mediterranean Sea. You can see it right there on the map. And there has been a great deal of intercourse between these two worlds, so that they have been in very close contact throughout the centuries. There's been a mutual influence running through the millenniums. When one regards India and China, on the other hand, you see in India the great Himalaya mountains and the sea roundabout. It is relatively isolated, and China, of course, is beyond the great Gobi deserts. So that influences from the Western sphere have come in rather small quantities and have been assimilated. There is a kind of continuity of tradition in these two cultures that is quite different from the great flux and change that we find in our Western world. Consequently, there's a kind of homogeneity, a kind of unity about the thinking of these two great culture worlds, and they stand in dramatic contrast to the situation in the West. Actually, the base, the ground base from which these two great cultures have received their fundamental ideas is the period of the Great Bronze Age. These are developments lasting to the present day in their traditions, in their classical traditions, of what might be termed a Bronze Age religiosity. Whereas in Europe, it is much more the Iron Age and then ages following. The Iron Age appears in the Western world as early as 1500 or 1200 BC. It reaches China and India only about 500 BC after the main culture forms have been established. Now, what do we find with respect to the basic ideas about religion and ethics that contrast these two worlds that I have divided? In the East, both in India and in China, in the way of this great unified early tradition which they have inherited and developed, the ultimate truth, the ultimate substance, the ultimate mystery of being is regarded as being absolutely beyond definition, absolutely beyond names and forms, beyond any categories whatsoever. To ask, as we do in the West, is God good, merciful, just, and all of this, is to fall short of the problem. These are anthropomorphic concepts, human qualities that are being projected onto a sphere of mystery that lies beyond the reach of those words. So we must say that from the standpoint of the East, the ultimate mystery of being absolutely transcends, lies beyond all description, all definition, all categories. Now, this is true, finally, in the West. But our orthodoxy doesn't usually talk that way. Even in St. Thomas Aquinas, who has written his great Summa Theologica, which discusses God's being, God's qualities, and all of this, in his Summa Contra Gentiles, in the fourth chapter, he says, "For then only do we know God truly, when we know that he lies beyond all that can be said or thought of God." That makes it transcendent. Similarly, those of you who've read and studied and digested your Kant know that for him, the forms of sensibility, time and space, which is exactly what in India is called Maya, the maker of the world illusion, time and space shut us away from experiencing and knowing the thing in itself, the Ding an sich, which corresponds to that transcendent principle. So that we do have this in our tradition, but it has not played a great role in the development of our religious life. It remains much more in the sphere of metaphysics and philosophy. Now, the next point. I have seen in India a simple stone taken and put a little ring of red powder around it. You regard that then not as a stone. You don't know its name. You're not going to use it. You regard it as a focus of the mystery of being itself. The existence of that stone, or of this thing, or of anything, is the same mystery as the existence of the universe. And you can take anything and use it as a point for meditation on that mystery. You put a ring around it which shuts it away from its common use, and it becomes then not a stone to be used, but a mystery to be regarded. This can be done to anything. Now that same mystery which we've regarded in the stone is your mystery. The mystery of your being is the same mystery as that. And so we can say that this mystery, this essence, this truth, is immanent as well as transcendent. Now that is the basic theme of the Oriental religiosity. Everything else is secondary to that. The goal of the religion, the goal of the philosophies, the goal even of the sociology, is to give the individual an experience, not simply a thought about it, but an experience of himself as that, an experience of identity. One of the earliest of the great Indian texts, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad from about the 7th century BC, we hear this statement which comes ringing down through the Orient, "Thou art that." You yourself are that divine thing, that mystery which you seek to know, only not in your normally recognized aspect and system of relationships. The reverence directed to a divinity in the temples of the Orient. This is only a preliminary discipline. The ultimate thing to realize is that that divine being that you are regarding there is a projection of your own divinity. Thou art that. And this is the goal. The gods themselves are as transitory and illusory as any other forms. The mystery lies beyond those forms and lies beyond those names. Therefore, in a religion where we say, this is the one God, his qualities are so and so and so and so, he has done this and that and so forth, he likes these people, he doesn't like these, all of this is sheer nonsense, and that's why this little man had to say, this is one of the reasons why, I don't find religion here. All he finds, so to say, is a kind of patriotism. And even when you read the Psalms, which to Christians are so edifying, look at them. O Lord, protect me against my enemies, I am righteous. And this whole I is the thing that seemed to this man, it would seem to an Oriental mind properly trained, to miss the point. Now when we turn to the West, what do we find in our great traditions? Our great religions have come largely from the Levant. The great religions of the Levant are Zoroastrianism, which is the mother religion of the whole tradition, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Here what we have is God has created the world. Creator and creature are not in substance identical. This is the key point. There is an ontological distinction. The divine and the created are not to be identified. Our religions, therefore, are religions that seek a relationship, not an identity with God. Next, God himself is responsible for the deliverance of a supernatural law and tradition through which the relationship is established. The institution that carries this is of prime importance to us for maintaining the relationship. Consider, the Hebrew tradition, there is the covenant between God and his people, and this covenant is honored in the laws which are written down in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, particularly Leviticus, Deuteronomy. These are the laws by which you obey this special supernatural law, the law of nature. The law of matter, the law of the senses, is corrupt. The fall in the Garden of Eden corrupted man and nature so that he cannot, turning inward, find the divine in there. When man turns inward here, what does he find? Not the divine. He finds a created soul, which may or may not be in proper relation to the divinity. He may very well find a totally corrupt soul. And so we have a totally different problem here. From the Oriental standpoint, this constitutes alienation from your own nature. You are told not to seek the divine there. Furthermore, you are given a supernatural law, which is not the law of nature, which alienates you still further and links you to the society, so that the society becomes the guidance to the divine. In the case of Judaism, for example, for the proper worship of divinity, there must be a minyan present, 10 Jewish males. This means that God is present in his society. And Jesus says, where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there. Consider the Hindu who goes, he's with society the greater part of his life, but then for the ultimate realization, he goes alone into the wilderness. These are two totally contrary points of view. Now when you have two entities, God and man, there comes another question. To whom is your ultimate loyalty given? To God or to man? And here's where we come to the distinction between the Levant and pagan Europe, before Christianity was brought in, the Europe of the Greeks and the Romans, and the early Celts and the Germans. In the book of Job, we have, one might say, the great text of Levantine piety. The submission and abdication of human judgment before the mystery and majesty and power of God. The point of the book is that God treated Job outrageously. He made a bet with the devil that this good man would finally not crack if God punished him for doing nothing evil. And Job's comforters, so-called, came to him and said, "You must have been wicked, Job, otherwise you would not have suffered so. Not be suffering so, your children taken from you, your house fallen down, your servants dead, and you here sitting with boils breaking out all of you on an ash dump. This is a terrible punishment that you're getting for something awful that you've done." Job says, "No, I've been a good man." And with that, God is challenged, and God comes. And does God say, "Look, Job, I made this bet"? Nothing like that. God says, "Are you big? I am. Can you fill the nose of Leviathan with harpoons? Try it. I did. Who are you, little man?" And Job, and this is the heroism of piety, abdicates his human judgment. He realizes that his little limited mind, with all of its human values and so forth, does not reach to the mystery of the divine. God is transcendent, but not imminent here. "O Lord, I have heard of thee with mine ears, now I behold thee with mine eyes, and I cover my head with ashes in shame that I questioned." No Greek would have done that, ever. Consider Prometheus, pinned to a rock by Zeus. Zeus could fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons. He was a big boy, too. And he sends a little delegation to Prometheus. The delegation says, "If you will apologize." And you remember what Aeschylus puts into the mouth of Prometheus. "I care less than nothing for Zeus. I despise him. Let him do as he likes." You know what happened to the Greek divinities? When they behaved like monsters, they lost the respect of man. You're afraid of a monster, yes, yes. But you don't honor him. You honor the human values which this deity has not yet come up to. And that was the Greek view. This we call humanism. The other is the piety of our churches. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we're humanists. Sunday, for half an hour, we're Job. Next week, we're at the psychoanalysts. Here is a tension of ideas, and it's no easy tension to resolve. from the Oriental point of view, this would be no problem. These are two aspects of a divine mystery. One in its small human conscious manifestation, and the other in its transcendent. And they're both within you here. And these are two aspects of your own being that you have to relate. Now, as I've said, the Hebrew tradition, we have a covenant between a God and his people, and it's this mystery of the covenant that is the juncture of two worlds. In the Christian tradition, it is the mystery of the incarnation, true God and true man. Jesus is both. For us, that's a mystery. No mystery at all for the Orient, because we're all true God and true man. The only difference between us and Jesus, or us and the Buddha, or us and Krishna, is we don't know it, and we don't act as though we were. In the Quran, the eternal word of God, in Arabic, there's a mystery there. It's revelation to man. But in India and in the Far East, the great mystery is the presence of this universal mystery among us all in these many, many forms. Now, there's a charming little anecdote, and the Indians are marvelous with their anecdotes, about a young man who learned from his guru, his teacher, that he was divine. I'll use the word God, because that's the word we have. So he says to his teacher, I am God. And the teacher says, you are. The stone is God. The trees, so forth. So filled with this feeling, the young man goes out for a walk. He's walking down a dusty road. And what is coming in the other direction? An elephant. The bells, they decorate elephants wonderfully. The bells going bling, blong as he comes along the road. And the mahout, the elephant driver on the elephant's head saying, get out of the way, you idiot. He thinks, I am God. The elephant is God. Should God be afraid of God? He's not going to get out of the way. Well, these elephants are quite wonderful, and when the elephant encounters this nut on the road, just wraps his trunk around him and poof, throws him off into the dust, lands on a rock, and oh. But the worst thing is what happened in his mind. So he goes back to his guru, lamed in body and spirit. The guru sees this tattered wretch coming in, and he says, well, what happened to you? Well, he said, you told me. And look, you said, and then he tells him the story. I'm God, the elephant's God, should God be afraid of God? Well, says the guru, yes, you are God. The elephant is God. But why didn't you listen to the voice of God shouting it from the elephant's head to get out of the way? Now they're both there, both the true God and the true man. And the nice balance that has to be achieved is between these two worlds. The whole world, then, is a manifestation of this divine principle. Now the Orient goes a step further. The Orient says, the social order also is a manifestation of this divine natural order. Here is a point where the Greeks stepped away. The social order is an order based on human values, not natural values. Men can decide what human ends are. They can invent means to achieve these ends. They can put them into play and move toward human ends. This adds a dynamic, creative principle to the social order, which comes up then through Roman law and this wonderful development of humanistic, human ideals with institutions to carry them. This the Orient lacks. The only way you can really change rule in the Orient is by shooting the one there before you. And this goes on. That's the way it happens. There is no development of this institutional life, nor is there any criticism of the tradition that has come to you. It is accepted without question. The Greeks also initiated this questioning of the tradition. Just read the story of the development of Greek philosophy from Thales through Xenophanes and so forth. Each one the student of the one before him, but with a new idea, a new quest. And from this we have developed this wonderful world of the sciences, which was not developed, as Orientals usually think it was, just to furnish gadgets. The gadgets are only the droppings from a quest for a new knowledge and a deeper understanding based on what the eye is seeing, not what somebody told you. And this has given us great power. But we mustn't confuse that power with this other power which the Orient has in its spiritual depth. We have a very strong ethical strain in our religiosity. And this is why we regard the Orient as being hardly religious, because the ethical principle, which is at the very root of our whole development, is not developed there. It remains in this static condition. The social order is the cosmic order, and so it is. Now, I want just very briefly to give a statement of the classical. Now, this is what's disintegrating in the Orient now under the impact of Western thought, but the traditional rigidity and hierarchy and fierceness of this early social structure. The best and strongest image of it is, of course, in the Indian caste system, which is now disintegrating, and there are great religious movements that are based on the breaking of caste. But until very recently, and now still in the provinces, it is a very strong tradition. According to this view, there are four classical castes. This is what we find in the Dharma Shastras, the great law books. There are thousands of castes, actually. Every trade is a caste, really, but they are classified in terms of these four great categories. The first caste, the top caste, is the priestly caste, the Brahmin caste. These are the men who know by heart the traditional books, the laws that have come down from the past. And like all priestly minds, they are minds full of clichés. These thoughts that have come on down, you don't have to have experienced anything, you just have to know how to say it and how to do it in a ritual. And so we have this traditionalism. The second caste is the governing caste, the Kshatriya. They govern in terms of the laws that the Brahmins have taught. That is to say, they do not govern in terms of humanly invented conventional laws, they govern in terms of what are thought to be the laws of the universe. And these are the laws of caste and the laws of the society. The third caste is the caste of money, the Vaishya, the established people, what we would call the middle class. The fourth caste is cut away by a very great gap, the Shudra. And this word is taken from a Sanskrit root that's said to mean to suffer. These are the artisans, the laborers, the working people, and they are divided into two groups. Those from whom a Brahmin may accept water, and those from whom a Brahmin may not accept water. Briefly, the clean and the unclean. Now, the Shudras traditionally are excluded from the teaching of the Vedas. There is actually a statement in the laws of Manu, if a Shudra hears the Vedas recited, even by chance, he shall have boiling lead poured into his ears. The power that comes through the religious rite is like atom power. It is something not to be leaked out to those who are not of the holy society. And as for the unclean, they can't even be touched. It is like being infected with a disease, a spiritual disease, to come near them. Now, this doesn't seem to us to be a very moral situation. To the Indian, it does. In the first place, this is the order of nature. Is it a moral situation that a cockroach should have one character and a lion another? Are we going to equate these? Are we going to make lions out of cockroaches and vice versa? They are born this way, and so is one born into one's caste, and that is one's nature, and the laws of life are those laws. But this is all rendered very, well, interesting, to say the least, by the notion of reincarnation. That is to say, through the experiences that are given to you during the course of a lifetime, you prepare yourself for another incarnation on a higher level. Now, I think of these four as the freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior classes. When you are a freshman, you may be a very, very good freshman, but this doesn't make you a junior or a senior. You have to wait for your next year. Similarly here, during one lifetime, one's caste does not change. One remains on that level. What is it that brings one up the scale? And here is the great theme word, selflessness. The erasure of that experience, I, mine. Everything is done to crush that, to liquidate it. Submission to dharma or law. Now this word, dharma, each caste has its own dharma. It comes from a Sanskrit root, dhri, which means support, to support. By performing one's duty as given, without question, one supports the universe. One participates in this great being, and this is no small experience either. Even for people in the most miserable state, one can feel it in India, the coming up of this beatitude, really, that comes to people who are in tune, down deep, with what they regard as the eternal. Now, actually, between years now, between your sophomore and junior years, you have a holiday. You go to the heaven of a beach, the Lido, or as James Joyce says, basking on the libido. Or you go to a hell, namely a summer school. Well, so it is here also, between lifetimes. If you have lived your life virtuously, that is to say, have submitted and learned the lesson of that incarnation, then you bask in a heaven for a certain number of eons in the kind of bliss that you're capable of enjoying. But if you have been stubborn and have held onto your ego, you will go to a hell and some real thuggish professors will be beating it into you. Those are the real devils. These are just the play devils that you meet here. Now, actually, these forecasts, they're in the upper story, even the Shudra. You can be born way down. You might have the misfortune to be born in the United States and not in India at all in relation to this wonderful saving tradition. Or you might be born an animal or way, way down in the plant or even the metal world. This tremendous image of the whole universe as, so to say, a progress of souls rising, 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 rising. I think of a pop bottle. When you take the top off, the bubbles start up. Where do they come from? The void. Where do they go? The void. The goal is, of course, to graduate, not to come back anymore. This is known as release. It's release from what? From ego, from being anybody, from being anything, from being caught in this phantasmagoria of illusions. Oh, we think we wouldn't like that. But we poor people have only one life. Suppose you had been coming back, 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 back. Well, finally you get the idea and it's time to go. This is where I came in. This is the spirit that's behind this world. Now transferring ourselves for a moment to the Far East. In India, one always feels that the center of concern, in the religious sphere at any rate, is this transcendent void, the void that is no void but a full void, so to say, that eternal being. In the Far East, both in China and in Japan, one gets the feeling, rather, of harmonious participation in the manifestation of the void in the world. That is to say, one rolls with the world. The Tao, as it's called, or the way, or order of the world. One participates with that and comes into harmony. So, Confucius, even, who is regarded as a sort of humanist, names the normal orders of relationship of human beings to each other. And through participating in these normal orders of relationship, one goes into touch with the Tao, or the way, on the level of human experience. The five relationships, as they're called, of monarch to minister, of father to son, of husband to wife, of older brother to younger brother, and of friend to friend. These are the typical relationships, so you get a kind of stasis there. It's remarkable. In India, there is no word really for individual. There is no such thing really as an individual human being. There is a person who represents perfectly or imperfectly the laws or patterns of his caste. Now, the person who has lived his life perfectly in terms of this order is said to be something. The Sanskrit word for to be, the root is sat, S-A-T. The feminine form, put a long I on the end of it, and you pronounce it sati. The wife who throws herself on her husband's funeral pyre, who carries the existence, the pattern of being a wife to the very hilt, all the way, thinking never of herself, but only of her role, is said to have become sati. The Indians do not say commit sati. This isn't an act of that kind. This is becoming the thing that you were to have been. A woman who does not do that is asat, non-being, is nothing. One can say, I think, that in the Orient, all the way from India to Japan, in traditional living, the whole of life is a sati. The individual is continually suppressing or wiping out his own personal criticism, his own personal judgment, in terms of the convention, in terms of the social order, in terms of what is demanded of him, in terms of his duty system. Now I want to move to the next phase of this. The members of the top three castes, in traditional times, I'm speaking of traditional times, this is all disintegrating now under the impact of all kinds of changes. But this is what is disintegrating, and this is what we think of as, and what is, Orient. Members of the top caste, the males at any rate, were expected to live life in terms of a certain pattern of stages. Four stages. Life is divided in the middle. The first half of life is to be lived in the community, in the village, performing your dharma, your duties. The second half of life, properly, is to be lived in the forest, practicing yoga, striving for, and in fortunate cases, achieving absolute release. Each half is divided in half, the first part of the half being devoted to study and learning, and the second to fulfillment. Now we begin as students then. In the old tradition, the first 15 years of life, student. The prime virtue of the student, two prime virtues are chastity and faith. One is to devote all of one's attention to one's teacher, the guru, and one is to have absolute faith, Shraddha, in his word. No criticism. The development of self-reliant judgment is absolutely suppressed. And this is a point that brings a radical contrast in. The ego is actually that function of the psyche which is concerned with the empirical environment, with initial judgment on your own part, with self-responsible decisions. And this is being suppressed, 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 so it isn't there. Or it's there in a very slight state. The creative imagination is suppressed. The word guru or teacher means something that it doesn't mean here at all. The guru isn't only a purveyor of information and discipline. He is a model. The student is to be like him. And what the guru is teaching, he got from his master, and he from his, until this glob of truth, so-called, comes down through the millenniums. And it does. It's amazing, the continuity of that tradition. You can hear people talking now in the temples, and I have done so, and then you can turn to a text from 700 BC, and there's the same thing in it. This is a remarkable continuity. Now, this is a darling story, which illustrates the quality of the guru. It's of a student who came late one day to his guru. He said, where have you been? Well, he said, there was a flood. My village is on the other side. There was no ferry boat. I was delayed. Was it the guru? Did the flood go down? Did the ferry boat come? No. Well, how did you get here? Was it the student? I just thought, my guru is my divinity. He is the divine purveyor of the divine truth. I'll just think about my guru, and I'll come, walk on the water. So I said, guru, 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 and here I am. Well, thought the guru. So when the student had gone, the guru looked around to see if anybody was looking, and he said, I'm going to test this. So he goes down to the river and he says, I, and he drowned. Now the reason he could work magic was that he wasn't there, so to say. He was not changing anything. He was a kind of conduit of truth which came through him. And so the spirit, spiritus, the wind, could walk on water. That's your guru. Now we come to the next stage, the householder. Marriage, or rather the solemnation of a marriage that was already established, often in childhood. None of this wonderful thing we have of choosing our own consort on the basis of what we imagine is going to be our ideal for life and all, building a life for yourself, none of that. This is done by the families and by marriage brokers, and when you open an Indian newspaper today, there are the columns advertising for wives. And in the old traditions, and this was true in China as well, and in Japan, the families did it all. None of this exercise of judgment and self-building. When the veil is removed and each sees other, that's it. And you might have to throw yourself on the funeral pyre of this fellow. And now suppose he turns out to be a bum. Suppose he turns out to be a horror and a brute. What about it? Well, there was a great Indian scholar here for many, many years, Ananda K. Kumaraswamy. He was a curator at the Boston Museum, and he's written many, many works on Indian philosophy, Indian art, and so forth. And he was asked, what about it, a situation like this? And his answer is, no woman would sacrifice her womanhood, her sat, simply because of the failure of a man. Now, this is something. The absolute impersonality implied in this, it doesn't matter who it is, what it is, what he's like, or anything else, you perform your duty, you perform your duty, you perform your duty. This impersonality is the impersonality of the universe, of the spheres. And it's a great, majestic, horrendous thing. And it is what animates that whole great Bronze Age tradition world. And it's in radical contrast to everything we have. And this is why, I often hesitate to say this, this is why communism is so much more strongly believed in the Oriental world than what we call democracy. What one wants are machines. What one needs are machines. One does not want individuals. They are frightening, they are dangerous, and they are dangerous. They can explode a society if the society isn't ready to assimilate them. Mao Zedong has compared, and point for point compared, the Marxian idea of the dialectic and the inevitable role of history with the Chinese idea of the Tao, the eternal revolution of light and dark, the changing of opposites into each other and so forth. And he has made a coordination like that of Marxism and the great philosophies of Tao. There's no jump at all. And suppose millions are liquidated. So what? I heard an Indian monk swat a fly, come back in a more acceptable form. I'm putting it rather extremely, but the individual is not this unique thing. The wonderful thing that one gets in the odes of Pindar, addressed to the wonderful youths who won the events in the Olympic Games. Youth will fade, death will come. But this moment of this youth's victory is a glory. And he, that one, not the other, but this one is what I'm looking at. This distinction that is made between this individual and that, even with the knowledge that death is going to take him away and that he's just a twinkle of a moment, that twinkle of a moment is what is affirmed here. And this is the tragic point of view. There is no such thing as an Oriental tragedy. You can't have a tragedy unless the individual means something. I'll never forget a great film that Shankar showed one time called Kalpa. My Lord, people went into the most tremendous experiences and they were eliminated, you know? Before you could think, there was another incarnation and there they were in another context. The hero in the Oriental, at least in the Indian and in the Buddhist mind, is not the individual. It is that reincarnating entity that puts individuals on and takes them off. There's a great word in the Bhagavad Gita. As a man puts on clothing and throws them away, so does the jiva put on bodies and throw them off. It's a totally different orientation. So when we go speaking about the rights of the individual, this is just what you don't want. This is devil talk. When we talk about democracy and the mingling of castes, this is the end of the world in terms of the tradition. When we talk about the progress of man, nobody believes it. The world is declining. This is called the Kali Yuga, the Yuga of the declining world. We are talking in reverse in every single point. Now, with that, I've got you where? We've just got married, haven't we? The first duty in marriage now, you've met this monster. The first duty in marriage is the honoring of the ancestral cult by having children, though that's a good, normal activity. If you start having children early in life, by the time you're in middle life, there will be a son present, competent to take over the duties of master of the great patriarchal family household. So daddy can now go into the woods and dismiss himself. Now, the great saint of the last century, Ramakrishna, said there are three ways of renunciation. There is gradual renunciation, there is sudden renunciation, there is monkey renunciation. Gradual renunciation is like this. The man realizes he's reaching midlife, the first gray hairs have begun to show, he's going into the forest, he's going to turn over the duties of his life to his son, and he's going to find a guru in the forest and practice yoga. So he has the permission of his Brahmin to do so, and in a beautiful ritual, he communicates his karma to his son. All of these rites, by the way, marriage rites and communication rites of this sort, are beautiful. The individual is filled with the sense of his relationship to the cosmic order. And you're willing to sacrifice your individual character in order to be aware of your divinity, you might say. So, having done this, he goes into the forest. That's gradual renunciation. Sudden renunciation is like this. A man and his wife are quarreling. The man leaves the hut to go down to a stream to wash. He's got his towel on his shoulder. And as he goes out, he says to his wife, "You shut up, or I'll walk out of here, I'll walk into the forest, I'll become a yogi, I'll renounce the world, and you'll never see me again." Oh, she says, "Don't be ridiculous. You've said things like this 1,000 times, you'll never do a thing like that." "I won't. Watch." He walks into the forest, with the towel on his shoulder, and devotes himself to yoga. That's sudden renunciation. Monkey renunciation is this. The youth goes to the yogis. A couple of weeks, the family gets a postcard saying, "Have found fine guru, everything going fine, nice little tapas grove here, getting headway." Or sitting on the top of a Park Avenue penthouse, meditating, wondering what the stock market's doing today. This is monkey renunciation. Nothing is any good in the way of monkey renunciation, but either the other two will work. So what does one do? One puts oneself to a guru. The guru sizes the individual up as to his spiritual capacity, and perhaps all he can do is give him the Gita to read, and here, take this. Or perhaps he's got a real character here, and he gives him yogic exercises. Now, some of these yogas are so fierce, you can hardly believe it. The goal in the old traditional yoga was to erase the last strain and trace of your humanity. Throughout the Dharma period, you have been obeying, doing what you should do. But perhaps there were some things that appealed to you. Perhaps there were other things that didn't. Now you have an opportunity to erase the memory of what appealed, to erase even the sense of knowing the difference between what appeals and what does not appeal, breaking that holding power of the spirit on the world, breaking the ring, and becoming an absolutely nobody. When this has been achieved, moksha, or release, has been achieved. And now you are also released from your yoga. You wander through the world as a wandering manifestation of the knower of the ultimate truth. These men, they wear the garb of a corpse, or are stark naked, having pulled out their hair with their hands. They have erased their humanity. That is the extreme of this last stage of release. Now, it was in relationship to this kind of extremity that the Buddha preached his doctrine. And there have been ameliorations since, right down through the Hindu line. The Buddha's view was that this is not the way to achieve proper release. The goal is not to kill your humanity. The goal is to kill your grip on illusion, to kill your fear, and to kill your desire. Not to erase your humanity, but to kill these two functions, and then to move in the world as what's called a Jivan Mukti, one who is released while living. I want to say a word about this Buddhist situation, because it will explain how Buddhism could have gone from India, where the trend is always to world renunciation and withdrawal, to China and Japan, where that trend does not exist. Both China and Japan are extremely aggressive in relation to the world, affirmative. The Buddha sat beneath a tree called the Tree of Illumination. This is the tree that was in the middle of the Garden of Eden that God didn't want man to get in touch with. Because if man eats of the fruit of this tree, he'll be as God, he'll be as one of us. Let's get him out of here. So he puts two cherubim at the gate of paradise and keeps us away. Well, the Buddha walked through the gate, you might say. And he came to that tree in the middle. This is called the immovable spot, because it's that point in the psyche where there is neither fear nor desire. You are nobody. You are absolutely void and still. And as the Buddha sat there, the Lord of Life came to him with two names. One name is Love, and the other is Death. And in the guise of Love, Karma, he parades before the seated sage his three beautiful daughters, whose names are Desire, Fulfillment, and Remorse. The Buddha didn't even think I, and so he didn't think they. There was nobody there. I don't know how the girls felt about this, but Karma, the Lord of Love, turns himself then in his wrath into the God of Death, and with horrendous tusks and necklace of skulls, he flings his army at the Buddha, and they fling all kinds of horrendous weapons. There was nobody there. The weapons arrive, and they turn to lotuses of praise and worship. And then this Lord of Love and Death assumes the other role of worldly experience, the Lord of Dharma, the Lord of Duty. And he says, you should be in school, you know. You are a prince. The Buddha simply let his hand touch the earth. That's called the earth-touching posture. You see it in Buddha images with one hand just touching the earth over his knee. And the earth goddess herself roars with a voice of thunder and says, this is my son who through innumerable lives has given of himself without stint and is nobody. He is not there, and he is worthy of this place. With that, the elephant on which Mara is riding bows, the army disperses, and that night the Buddha achieved his absolute illumination. And he was so stricken, so stunned by what he experienced that he sat riveted for 7 days. Then he moved away and stood 7 paces away and looked where he had been sitting, looked at this for 7 days. Then he walked back and forth for 7 days. He's assimilating this thing. Then he goes off and sits under another tree and says, this cannot be taught. And now no experience can be taught. Buddhism above all. The first point about Buddhism is it cannot be taught. So no sooner did he have that thought that down come the gods and they all said, teach. So he said, I will teach. And so what does he teach? He teaches the way to illumination. You know the saying, you can bring a girl to Vasa, but you can't make her think. You can bring a person to the point of Buddhist illumination, but you can't make it happen. It has to happen from inside. And so Buddhism is called a jhana, Buddhism is a ferry boat, a vehicle to carry you someplace across the water. We are on this shore of time and space and vicissitudes. And we're a little sick of it now after thousands of incarnations. And we've heard about nirvana. The word literally means beyond wind, the place where the winds do not blow. And between us is this wind-beaten stream. We want to go to beyond the shore. And so here we're sitting in our room wanting to go to the beyond the shore. And along comes a little ferry boat, and there's a man in it, the Buddha, and he says, "Who's for nirvana?" And you say, "I am." And he says, "Remember, you don't come back here. You're giving up your name, your fame, your family, your loves, your hopes." You said, "I'm sick of it. I'm for it." So you get aboard, you think, "Oh, mother, mother." And then the boat pulls out, "Too late for mother, you're off." Now you're on the way to the beyond the shore. This is the life now of the monk. Seamanship, waves, wind, what do you do with this rope? You can't say right and left, you've got to say starboard and port. Everything has changed, but you're not over there yet. You know no more about nirvana than the person on this shore. You're just learning how to row a boat. A monk, how to get across the water. Well, it's a longer trip than you thought. It may take half a dozen lifetimes, but finally, you get there. And now, says the Buddha in a wonderful sermon, "Oh, monks, suppose a man wishing to get to beyond the shore were to build himself a boat and actually reach beyond the shore. And now, suppose that out of regard and love for that boat, he should pick it up and carry it on his back. Would that be an intelligent man?" "Oh no, blessed one," said the monks, "that would not be an intelligent man." "So also," said the Buddha, "with the laws of the order, they have nothing to do with nirvana." So we leave the boat, now we're in nirvana. Beyond self, beyond this and that. And over there we think, let's look back and see how Sweetbriar looks from here. There is no other shore, because we are beyond two-ness now, no this and that. There's no river between, there's no ferry boat, there's no man in the boat, there's no Buddhism, there's no Buddha. It was all a strange dream. This, my dear friends, is the way nirvana looks from this side. This is it. The doctrine now is, this is nirvana, and the delights of this life, and the stupidities of this life, and the merciless ruthlessness of this life, and the kindnesses of this life. This is all the manifestation of nirvana. This world, as one great teacher says, with all of its pain, all of its agony, all of its sicknesses, is the golden lotus world of perfection. And if it doesn't look that way to you, nothing wrong with the world, you're out of focus. The problem is to change your focus and not to bind yourself to it, not to bind yourself to your group, not to bind yourself to your wishes, your hopes. You abandon all that, the world opens up with a wonderful glory. And this is that goal. And so we can now affirm it. We can now say yes to it in fullness. This is the point of view of what is known as the Bodhisattva, the one who addresses himself to the world in mercy. Now there are two Buddhisms. There's the Buddhism of those on this shore wanting to go to the other shore, who are daring to get into the boat. And this is called Hinayana Buddhism, little ferry boat Buddhism, or the Buddhism of the smaller way. And it's the Buddhism of the monk way. But when the monks have got over there, what do they find? Everybody's there. So where are you going, buddy? This is called the big ferry boat Buddhism. We're all on it. The first doctrine of Buddhism is all things are without a self, so you have no self to save, so you're there. The only thing is, you don't realize it yet. I heard a wonderful sermon once by Dr. Suzuki, and he said, well, perhaps you don't know this, but when the Buddha was born, this little baby, the gods came down on golden cloth and received the child and set him on the ground. And the newborn infant took seven steps And he pointed up, and he pointed down, and he said, "Worlds above, worlds beneath, no one in the world like me." Well, said Dr. Suzuki, he's a little man with eyebrows like this, he was like a little ceramic figure. He said, "That very funny thing. Little baby say thing like that. You'd think he might have waited. You think he might have waited till he had illumination and second birth, spiritual birth." But he said, "You know, we in the Orient, we're all mixed up. We do not make big distinction between material and spiritual. The material is actually the manifestation of the spiritual." Then he went on with his talk, and since in Japan, as I understand, it's not polite to talk too well, that alienates the audience. So he made believe to lose his notes, and we helped him find them, and this invocation of your sympathy and participation was carried on. And finally, he came around by the long route, and he said, "They tell me when baby is born, baby cries. What does baby say when baby cries?" "You know, worlds above, worlds beneath, no one in the world like me." "That's what the baby says." He says, "All babies, Buddha babies. All of us, Buddha things. But what's the difference between your baby and the Buddha?" That little baby knew he was a Buddha thing. And he acted out of that knowledge. The Buddha, the incarnation, is simply Godhood manifesting itself through a human being who knows he's God. But it manifests itself also in the trees and the mountains. I've heard arguments as to whether trees and mountains know their Buddha things. The whole world is a symphony of consciousness, and we participate in it, each in his own way. It's a glorious, glorious thought. This is the positive, wonderful thing. And so when Buddhism went to China, the Buddha dates 563 to 483 BC, about 67 AD, Buddhism went to China. By about 500 AD, it was well integrated into Chinese life, and then went to Japan. Now, Japan at that time was a comparatively barbaric country, just as Europe was at exactly that time. That was the time when Christianity was coming into Europe. And these relatively barbaric people assimilating this new doctrine. Buddhism assimilates very easily because it says all things are Buddha things, so that the local deities can be realized as manifestations of the Buddha principle in the world. And so this wonderful juncture takes place between the Buddhist doctrine, which in India is a kind of nay with respect to the world, with this positive affirmation of the world in Japan. I tell my friends who are thinking of psychoanalysis, my male friends, don't spend your money on a psychoanalyst, go to Japan. There you get in touch with good primary paganism. None of this notion that nature is corrupt. There's this wonderful word that comes through the Shinto texts. The processes of nature cannot be evil. And so one finds one's nature again. This sense of alienation from the divine is somewhere else. And the society will tell you how to get to it is thrown away, and you are turned inward in yourself, to find the face that you had before you were born, so to say. Well, now finally, to conclude this, let me tell one little anecdote more. This is my favorite with respect to Oriental teaching. This is the story of a tigress who was starving and was pregnant. She came to a herd of goats and pounced at these, and the violence of the pounce brought on the birth of the little tiger and her own death. So the goats scattered, and when they came back, what did they find? They find a newborn tiger and its dead mother. Well, with their strong parental instincts, they adopted the little tiger, so he grew up thinking he was a goat. Now, you know the situation. His teeth were not good for eating grass. His stomach wasn't good for digesting grass. So he grew up to be a pretty miserable specimen of his kind. And just at about the time that this poor thing reached adolescence, a great big male tiger pounced on the same herd, and all the goats scattered. But this little thing, after all, was a tiger. And so there was this thing standing. The big one looks at him and thinks, and says, "Why, for heaven's sakes, what are you doing here living among goats?" "Meh." Nibbles a bit of grass, Well, this is a shock. The big fellow gives him a smack or two. And all he gets are these silly bleats. So then he takes him by the neck and brings him to a still pond. I've told you, nirvana, where the wind does not blow. When the wind blows on a pond, you have all these rippling waves. And all you see are broken fragments of images. When the pond is still, the image is there, which was all broken up. Our minds are in movement that way. The first great aphorism in the great work on yoga, the Yoga Sutras, says, yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous activity of the mind substance. Our minds are always in a ripple, so all we see are broken fragments. That's what we're all looking at here. Try to think of something that you think you'd like to think about. Hold it in your mind. Look at your watch and say, I'm going to think about Jimmy. And you'll suddenly find, you'll immediately find, that you're thinking associated thoughts. You can't hold one thought. Well, yoga is the stopping of all this activity. Even yourself. You know how shadows are, the waves. These are the waves of time. Here I am. I'm gone. That's because you identified yourself with the shadow flickering on the wave. You are, that's not you. You are that substantial image that you're going to see when the water stops rippling, when your mind stands still. So the little tiger's looking over, and he sees his own face. He'd never seen it before. And you've never seen what you'll see when you stop your mind. The big fellow, the guru, his face is in there too, and he says, look, you've got a face like mine. That's a pot face like mine. That's a tiger face. That's not a ghost face. A little thing now, something's sinking in. But he's terribly troubled. The big fellow again grabs him by the neck and takes him up to his den. Got a big bloody chunk of gazelle there. Have a piece. He backs away. I'm a vegetarian. Well, the big tiger takes a piece of meat and jams it down his throat. He gags, he chokes, says the text, as all do on true doctrine. So, in goes the true doctrine. And he begins to feel in his veins and nerves this exhilaration. It's his own nature coming to life because he swallowed true doctrine. It will waken your own true nature, not this thing society's been giving you, this bunch of goats. It stretches, big, long stretch. And a kind of preliminary tiger roar comes out of his unpracticed throat. Oh, says the big fella, now we're getting there. Now we go into the woods and hunt our proper food. And the moral, my dear friends, we are all tigers living among goats, alienated from our tiger natures by the food we've been given, this grass. Turn inward, find your own tiger face shining bright in the forest of the night.
In Eastern traditions, the ultimate ground of being, the ultimate truth, if you will, is beyond human understanding. There are some Western philosophers that come to that point, like Thomas Aquinas and Immanuel Kant, but it's a concept that hasn't had a terribly large influence on religious thinking and religious life in the West. It's remained confined mostly to philosophy, particularly metaphysics, and the religious experience of the divine is largely one of relationship. In the East, however, the goal is to realize that while one's being is obviously immanent, that we exist, that we are here, it is also at the same time transcendent, beyond perception, independent of the universe, beyond names and forms, beyond any material investigation or factual understanding. At first glance, this may seem to constitute an insurmountable paradox, but only at first glance. When we think mythologically, we may start to recognize paradox as a quality of the mythical situation, as an indication, if you will, that the gods are near. In other words, the universal energies that the metaphor implicit in the word God tries to capture are in operation. In Eastern traditions, any object, including oneself, may be regarded as the focus of the mystery of existence. Professor Campbell gives the example of marking a red circle around a rock. And even this very crude, simple gesture may create sacred space. The red circle separates the rock from its customary environs, and while we apprehend the form, we may also experience the rock, not as a mere rock, but in its manifestation of the unapprehendable, unknowable mystery that makes its appearance in it. One may see in its familiar rockness the splendor and impenetrable mystery of existence. In Western religious traditions, there is nothing mysterious about existence. A God who knew what he was doing was responsible. I should mention that in Eastern religious traditions, it may likewise seem that various gods are responsible for various universal phenomena. But these divinities are projections of one's own divinity. The gods of the East are gateways to the mystery and only preliminary to, as Campbell often put it, becoming transparent to the transcendent. And when we speak about God in the West, we most always refer to a single and singular deity, generally from the Levant, as in Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And this God and his creation are decidedly not the same. As Professor Campbell put it, quote, "there is substantial, palpable distance," unquote, between the God of the West and his creation. So a relationship has to be established, and institutions are created to maintain and enforce the terms of the relationship. The terms of the relationship, by the way, is the law given to humans by God. But this relational distance may be, shall we say, challenging at times, if not downright disastrous for humans, since one is at the mercy of this infinitely more powerful and sometimes illogical and unreasonable being. For instance, regarding the book of Job, Campbell says that God treats Job outrageously. The text tells us right at the beginning that Job is a righteous man, that he is blameless and upright. But God makes a bet with Satan that if all his blessings and comforts were removed from him, Job would likely curse God. God takes Satan's bet, despite knowing how loyal and faithful Job has been. It seems like this has very little to do with Job, but is more about the mimetic rivalry that exists between Satan and God. And I should add parenthetically that by mimetic rivalry, I'm referring to René Girard and his theory of mimetic desire, which accounts for phenomena such as violence and scapegoating. And while this is not the place to enter into a discussion of Girard's theory, the listener will not, I assure you, be disappointed by looking into the work of René Girard. Regardless, God allows for Job's wealth to be lost, his children to be killed, and for Job himself to suffer terrible physical ailments. But Job still doesn't curse God. He does, however, call God to account for his disproportionate anger and his injustice. The text tells us that God answered Job out of a whirlwind and berates Job's weakness and ignorance, yet never addresses Job's legitimate concerns. Campbell rightly notes that, comparing Job with the Prometheus myth, that gods who lack something like humanity or human values are considered to be monstrous, and that's certainly the impression one has of Job's God. A curious thing happens as Job, who has not recanted his grievances against God, but nevertheless submits to the will of this monstrous God who's made it abundantly clear that worse is in store for Job if he doesn't. God apparently realizes at some point that Job has spoken the truth about him and says, quote, "only to him," referring to Job, "will I show favor," unquote. This may be an indication of some evidence for an evolving sense of what we would call ethical behavior on the part of God. C.G. Jung certainly thought so. In his book, Answer to Job, Jung imagines that God sent his son as a sacrifice, as a way to atone for his own sins. In most of the Asian religious traditions, Professor Campbell points out, no such relationship exists. There are only two aspects to the divine mystery: immanence and transcendence, and they are both within, and the view of the East is that society reflects divine order rather than human achievement. In other words, society cannot be other than it is, regardless of how hard it is on human beings, subjecting them to caste systems, slavery, violence, and more. In these respects, society is reflecting nature. Now, the Greeks moved away from this sort of thinking, Campbell reasons, deciding that humankind can decide what its goals, ethics, and ideals shall be. And from this shift, humanism arises. Around 25 minutes into this lecture, Professor Campbell discusses the concept of reincarnation. And it's interesting to point out that more than half the world's population believes in reincarnation. And perhaps surprisingly, not all of them are in the East. The country with the highest percentage of belief in reincarnation is Hungary, at 13% of its population. But traditionally, there are rather stark differences between the East and the West in their respective considerations of death. Let me quote from C.G. Jung, writing that death is, quote, simply a psychic activity that transcends the limits of consciousness. Death means psychologically beyond consciousness. There is positively nothing else it could mean, since statements about immortality can only be made by the living, who as such are not exactly in a position to pontificate about conditions beyond the grave, unquote. In the West, one will typically find that people believe nothing happens after death, or alternatively, that one's existence is carried on in something like the Christian or Islamic versions of heaven. But whether there is or is not life after death, death is necessary. And honestly, I don't understand how something that every living thing must experience can be bad. Even so, in the Western world, and particularly in America, death is seen as an enemy, an intruder breaking down the door of life, a foe that should be fought and resisted with every fiber of one's being. In Eastern traditions, the lack of ego, submission to the Dharma, and the acceptance of one's life and state of being affirms and supports the cosmic reality. And death is simply another experience of life. It's not a punishment, nor is it a tragedy. And as such, it may be accepted with equanimity. Professor Campbell notes that there is no word for individual in Sanskrit. We bubble up from the void and dissolve back in it. The cycle of existence and non-existence goes on, and in it, the person is not a unique entity. In fact, the entity, Campbell says, the mystery itself, puts on a person and takes it off. This attitude makes possible a different relationship to death and to life, as well as a different relationship to beauty. The apprehension of beauty may in fact be the product of a kind of alchemy of impermanence, our own, as well as the rarity, strangeness, fragility, and impermanence of the observed. Beauty is ephemeral. The experience of beauty is ephemeral. I can't experience the exact same beauty twice. It's often hard to grasp, it's often surprising, and it doesn't remain around indefinitely. Even living in a place of beauty, such as I'm fortunate to do, one eventually habituates to it to some degree. That's human nature, and the experience of beauty depends upon death for its meaning. A 14th century Zen poet, Yoshida Kenko, wrote, quote, "If we lived forever, never to vanish like the dews of Adashino, never to fade like the crematory smoke on Toribiyama, men would scarcely feel the beauty of things," unquote. We see beauty because we, and often the beautifully regarded thing, are impermanent. At the end of his lecture, Professor Campbell tells one of his favorite stories, that of the tiger and the goats. And I have to say, it is delightful to hear Campbell bleat like a goat. He describes, with the aid of this story, how we, like the young tiger, have been alienated from our true nature by our spiritual diet, by the spiritual food we've been given, the religions, materialisms, mythologies, histories, and so forth, that when we finally consume the true doctrine, we gag on it. finding it to be disagreeable enough to gag on, how many of us will continue to ingest the truth? Nietzsche remarked that we have art so that we don't die of the truth. And mythology functions the same way, as a sort of seasoning to make the truth more appealing, so that we are less likely to gag on it. We find ourselves now in the same circumstance as the young, orphan, scrawny, and timid tiger, believing ourselves to be something other and much less powerful than we are. But with the proper diet, we might begin to glimpse what we really are, though wedded to form we may be. Campbell spoke to this particular story in the epilogue of a book titled The Hero's Journey, Joseph Campbell on His Life and Work, saying, "Now that you've found your tiger face, how will you go on living with these goats?" And I'm quoting from the book now. "What you will have learned is through all the forms of the world, the one radiance of eternity shows itself. You can regard the appearance of the miracle of life in all these forms, but don't let them know you're a tiger," unquote. You may in fact discover that you're not just any tiger, but rather you belong to the order of William Blake's tiger. We all know the poem, "Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?" The answer to Blake? You did. Or at least the wondrous mystery that is wearing the you suit at this particular moment did. You simply haven't realized it yet. Thank you for listening. And I'll be back next month with another Joseph Campbell lecture on our Joseph Campbell Foundation podcast, Pathways with Joseph Campbell.
Pathways with Joseph Campbell is a production of the Joseph Campbell Foundation and the Mythmaker Podcast Network, and is produced by John Booker and Elias Smirnoff. Executive producer Robert Walter. Your host has been Bradley Olson. Editing and audio services provided by Seth Balin. Music exclusively provided by APM Music. For more podcasts and information about Joseph Campbell, please visit jcf.org.